Welcome to a fragment of time. My name is Andy Manity, and you are listening to coradio.org.
If certain acts of violation of treaties are crimes, they are crimes whether the United States does them or whether Germany does them. And we are not prepared to lay down a rule of criminal conduct against others, which we would not be willing to have invoked against us. We must never forget that the record on which we judge these defendants is the record on which history will judge us tomorrow. To pass these defendants a poisoned chalice is to put it to our own lips as well. That's a clear and honorable statement of the principle of universality. But the judgment at Nuremberg, which had just concluded, crucially violated that principle, consciously and explicitly. The tribunal had the task of defining war crime and crimes against humanity. It crafted these definitions very carefully so that crimes are criminal only if they were not committed by the Allies. So urban bombing of civilian concentrations was excluded from the tribunal because the Allies carried it out more barbarically than the Nazis. And subsequent tribunals are discredited by the same moral flaw, but the self-exemption of the powerful from international law and elementary moral principles bars any discussion of these unwelcome truisms.
The Nuremberg trials were the trials after World War II, where they decided what would be a war crime. Terrible crimes were committed, and there had to be action to ensure this would never happen to human beings again. The main conclusion was that the most supreme war crime is the act of aggression which encompasses all of the crimes that occurred from it. A stark reminder that the country that starts the war is the bad guy that must be stopped. Can you think of a country that has committed the supreme war crime of aggression? Well, can you think of a country that has committed the supreme war crime, which contains the responsibility for all of the crimes committed because of it? This is the act of a country that is a criminal and a murderer.
Some people say that I'm a bad guy. But I can change, I can learn to keep my promises, I swear it. Open up my heart and I will tear it, any minute now I swear I'll share it. Oh, it's strange, yes it's strange, oh I guess it's quite clear. I killed the antelope and deer and there's no home on my range inside my little deranged, but I can change. can change. I can learn to keep my promises, I swear it. Open up my heart and I will dare it. Any minute now, I swear I'll share it. I'm gonna
third background issue, defining terror and distinguishing it from aggression and legitimate resistance. Calculated use of violence or threat of violence to attain goals that are political, religious, or ideological in nature through intimidation, coercion, or instilling fear, typically targeting civilians.
Somehow, neither of them could imagine that there are things that go on in the world that the United States has no control over, has very little control over. Both of them like to think that they were responsible. If not the Republican Party, the Democratic Party. If not either of them, both of them together. And so he was asserting, that Gore was asserting that we had a bipartisan foreign policy. Now, I don't think it's been a good foreign policy. I don't think we've had a foreign policy. I'm talking, well, we can go back as far as we can in history. I'll go back temporarily. I don't know whether I'll feel like going back further, but at least temporarily, I'll just go back to the post-war period, the post-World War II period, and say, you know, that our foreign policy, it seems to me, has not been based on really promoting democracy in the world, although that's very often what we think.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Oh, what we're told to think about our foreign policy, this is what we care about. We only want to promote democracy in the world. But looking at our foreign policy since the end of World War II, it hasn't seemed that way. That is, it seems that we have again and again not supported democracy in the world, but supported dictatorships in the world.
This is about people, all of us, who are passionate in learning about our society, our politics, and our confinements. This is everything, and everyone, who has the time and means to research, think, and feel something powerful about what we have learned.
Five, six.
What does loss mean to individuals? What does it mean to whole cultures, whole people who have learned to live with it as a constant companion? Since it is September 11th we're talking about, perhaps it's in the fitness of things that we remember what that date means, not only to those who lost their loved ones in America, but to those in other parts of the world to whom that date has long held significance. This historical dredging is not offered as an accusation or a provocation, but just to share the grief of history, to thin the mist a little. Say to the citizens of America in the gentlest, most human way, welcome to the world. In Chile, on the 11th of September 1973, General Pinochet overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende in a CIA-backed coup. In the regime of terror that ensued, thousands of people were killed. Many more simply disappeared. Firing squads conducted public executions. Concentration camps and torture chambers were opened across the country. The dead were buried in mine shafts and unmarked graves. For 17 years, the people of Chile lived in dread of the midnight knock, of routine disappearances, of sudden arrest and torture. In 1999, following the arrest of General Pinochet in Britain, thousands of secret documents were declassified by the U.S. government. They contain unequivocal evidence of the CIA's involvement in the coup, as well as the fact that the U.S. government had detailed information about the situation in Chile during General Pinochet's reign. Yet, Kissinger assured the general of his support. In the United States, as you know, we are sympathetic to what you're trying to do, he said. We wish your government well. Those of us who have only ever known life in a democracy, however flawed, would find it hard to imagine what living in a dictatorship and enduring the absolute loss of freedom means. It isn't just those who Pinochet murdered, but the lives he stole from the living that must be accounted for too. Sadly, Chile was not the only country in South America to be singled out for the US government's attentions. Guatemala, Costa Rica, Ecuador, Brazil, Peru, the Dominican Republic, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Honduras, Panama, El Salvador, Mexico, and Colombia. They've all been the playground for covert and overt operations by the CIA. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been killed, tortured, or have simply disappeared under the despotic regimes that were propped up in their countries. If this were not humiliation enough, the people of South America have had to bear the cross of being branded as people who are incapable of democracy, as if coups and massacres are somehow encrypted in their genes. This list does not, of course, include countries in Africa or Asia that suffered US military interventions: Vietnam, Korea, Indonesia, Laos, and Cambodia. For how many Septembers, for decades together, have millions of Asian people been bombed and burned and slaughtered?
In 1975, as the war in Vietnam came to an end, Congress took its first public look at the secret government. The hearings opened the books on a string of lethal activities, from the use of electric pistols and poison pellets to mafia connections and drug experiments. And they gave us a detailed account of assassination plots against foreign leaders and the overthrowing of sovereign governments. We learned, for example, how the Nixon administration had waged a covert war against the government of Chile's president, Salvador Allende, who was ultimately overthrown by a military coup and assassinated.
Like Caesar peering into the colonies from distant Rome, Nixon said the choice of government by the Chileans was unacceptable to the president of the United States. The attitude in the White House seemed to be, if in the wake of Vietnam I can no longer send in the Marines, then I will send in the CIA.
But the secret government had also waged war on the American people. The hearings examined a long train of covert actions at home, from the bugging of Martin Luther King by the FBI under Kennedy and Johnson to gross violations of the law and of civil liberties in the 1970s. They went under code names such as Chaos, Cable Splicer, Garden Plot, and Leprechaun. According to the hearings, the secret government had been given a license to reach all the way to every mailbox, every college campus, every telephone, and every home.
Discussion questions. 1. If con is the opposite of pro, then isn't Congress the opposite of progress? Or did we just fucking blow your mind? 2. What does bicameral mean? Are any of the girls in your class bicameral? 3. Which would you rather see getting made, sausage or laws? 4. In Star Wars Episode 2, Chancellor Palpatine convinces the Galactic Senate to grant him emergency powers in order to squelch the Separatist movement's droid army, led by Count Dooku. But Palpatine ultimately abuses his authority, disbanding the Republic and appointing himself the lone ruler of a new galactic empire. Could it happen here? 5. How are you enjoying this program so far? Be honest. 6. Remember that old Schoolhouse Rock cartoon about the Bill who sings a song about how he becomes a law? Hey, and what about the Snorks? Remember them? Classroom activities. 1. Take instruction paper, trace your hand, and make a turkey of Congress. 2. Ask your students to choreograph an interpretive dance or compose a tone poem that represents the spirit of their favorite piece of legislation currently under consideration by a Senate subcommittee. 3. Find out each representative's porn name by adding the name of the largest city in their district to the name of their state flower. Example, Ben Chandler, Democrat, Kentucky, is Frankfurt Goldenrod. 4. Help the children make their own mace, the ebony and silver rod on the house rostrum symbolizing the authority of the house, out of paper towel rolls and elbow macaroni. Explain to the children they have just made useless representations of something that is itself useless and symbolic. Shame them. 5. Have fun with the gerrymander. Take 5 congressional districts in rural Texas that have experienced a sudden upswing in minority population. Using only 3 straight lines, can you redraw the boundaries to consolidate white power in 4 of the 5 districts?
One hand on this wily comet. Take a drink just to give me some weight. Some Uberman I'd make, I'm barely a vapor. There shone a chlorine light on a host of individual sins. Let's carve my aging face off. Fetch us a knife. Start with my eyes down so the lines form a grimacing smile. Close your eyes to corral a virtue. Is this fooling anyone else? Never worked so long and hard to cement a failure. We can blow on our thumbs and posture, but the lonely are such delicate things. The wind from a wasp could blow them into the sea with stones on their feet. Lost to the light and the loving we need.
So what we have to be able to do for you to have what you really want is we've got to dig out those beliefs. So what we have to be able to do for you to have what you really want is we've got to dig out those beliefs. So what we have to be able to do for you to have what you really want is we've got to dig out those beliefs. We've got to dig out those beliefs.
In a democracy, the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the general population, have to be kept from interfering. They can be spectators, but not participants.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do.
Spectators, but not participants.
It's time to talk about censorship.
Send this song to 20 people.
But isn't it stealing?
At your name, don't break the cycle.
From people to people.
Pass it along.
People like MP3s.
Pass it along.
How about trying this future on for size?
When it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
When it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
You can't legislate people's behavior.
We do what we want to do, you know. If they consider that selling out, then whatever. Whatever. Whatever.
Who run Napster should be in prison.
It's time to talk about censorship.
Send this song to 20 people.
And isn't it stealing?
At your name, don't break the cycle.
From people to people.
Pass it along.
People like MP3s.
Pass it along.
Consumer want to download music for free.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do. People are going to do what they want to do.
How about trying this future on for size?
When it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants. Spectators, but not participants.
You can't legislate people's behavior.
We don't mind when our fans pay money to wear our promotional t-shirts. And it's fine when they pay $40 to come to one of our concerts. But when our fans think they can listen to our music for free, they just cross the line.
My name is Andy Mamadi. And you are listening to A Fragment of Time on CoRadio.org.
No pasarán, no pasarán, los días de los filmes están tempe duro, roca viva, que al fascismo aplastará, vencerá, bomba 5, bayonetas, al combate acero va, pasará. No pasarán, no pasarán, por la tierra y por el pan. Vista frente, pulso firme, los fusiles apuntan, disparan, sal de tierra, cañonazos, nada importa, cero va, pasará. No pasarán, no pasarán, el fascismo. Se detendrá ante el muro de granito que el acero le opondrá. Vencerá por la España antifascista. A la guerra cero va, pasará.
We've done it in Asia, we've done it in the Middle East, we're still doing it in the Middle East. You know, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia are not exactly democracies. In Latin America, so we supported dictator after dictator after dictator, tyrant after tyrant after tyrant. And when we didn't have somebody in office that we liked, we would overthrow that government, or help to overthrow that government, or secretly overthrow that government, as we did in Guatemala and Chile. And usually the result was not democracy, usually the result was a tyranny. And this was before Vietnam. With Vietnam, a lot of Americans began to question not only our policy in Vietnam, But our policy in general, does people began to reconsider, because when they saw during the Vietnam War a pattern of deception of the American public, telling stories to the American public which turned out not to be true, you know, stories about how we were doing this to support democracy, you know, in Vietnam. Well, people began to look beyond Vietnam and began to question our foreign policy in general. The interesting thing about this foreign policy, what I would call an undemocratic foreign policy, a foreign policy really not designed to bring about justice in the world, but a foreign policy designed to enhance American power in the world. Now, I know there are some people who think, well, if you enhance American power, you automatically enhance justice and democracy. But I don't think that's true. And national power in itself is not a guarantee of democracy. If you look at this foreign policy, you see that it has been bipartisan. Both Democrats and Republicans have engaged in a foreign policy which was aggressive and expansionist and macho. Sure, the Soviet Union was aggressive and expansionist and macho, and we were aggressive and expansionist and macho.
I am the stone that the builder refused. I am the visual, the inspiration that made ladies sing the blues. I'm the spark that makes your idea bright. The same spark that lights the dark so that you can know your left from your right. I am the ballad in your box, the bullet in the gun, the inner glow that let you know to call your brother son. The story that just begun, the promise of what's to come. And I'ma remain a soldier till the war is won. Chop, 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 flip. Chop, chop, chop,
I was in, I live in New York, and I was in New York for September 11th. You know, as you know, if you were here, it was a really very confusing and upsetting, traumatic. And I remember distinctly the first 72 hours, just that almost childlike, vulnerable feeling of like, what's happening? What's going on? What is going to be happen next week? What is next week going to look like? What do we do? What do we do? And you have the information. We're just waiting for any voice of authority to tell us what to do. Are we going to be safe? What do we do? And I remember, and I honestly, I think this is the time when I was truly proudest to be American. And I remember turning on the TV and seeing the face of Tom Ridge telling me to go to the Home Depot and get some duct tape and plastic sheeting. And I stood up and I saluted the flag. I had one little tear like the Indian man did. Remember when you threw the wrapper on the ground and the Indian cried? That's what I was like. I was like, yes, you got it. This is the greatest country. And at first I was like, that's a joke, right? That's a funny joke that the government's telling us to lighten things up a little, like, and that's the joke, and then they're going to go, no, but in all seriousness, this is what you should do. But then that was it, like, duct tape and plastic sheeting. And I was like, are you fucking shitting me? Why don't I just cover my head and get under a school desk? I mean, what the fuck are you telling me? I was incredulous. But then, they explained it. It's like, look, no. You don't just throw up plastic sheeting and duct tape just haphazardly. You know, you really seal off the plastic sheeting, and then it's two layers of duct tape, people. Duh. Don't let us finish. Please, let us finish. It's two layers of duct tape, okay? And then what that does is if you do it really tight and really, like, specifically like they said to do it, then what that does is that prevents nuclear bombs from entering your skin. All right. I'm no scientist. I don't know. You guys got it. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for asking. That was silly. No, but I did, I did go to get, my World War III prevention kit that government sanctioned. But the one I got, I wasn't going to get duct tape and plastic sheeting. That's absurd. But I did go and get one, and I got the most expensive one, the premium pack, and it was $4,200.
Sorry.
Yeah, fuck you. I think I'm worth it. Thanks. A lot. No, but it's all like government approved, you know. There's Tom Ridges, smiling face, thumbs up, ding, you know, and it's like a veritable rainbow coalition of colors. What the package is it consists of a zinc lozenge, a nickel, and a wish. And how it works is the zinc lozenge is for your throat, you know. Because, you know, a nuclear bomb will fuck up your throat pretty bad. It will, guys. It will. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've woken up and been like, fuck, did a nuclear bomb go off? I could barely swallow. And the nickel is for, because, like, in post-apocalyptic times, a nickel's going to be worth, like, $1 million. And a wish is a wish, you know. Oh, and a jet ski. There's a jet ski, too. I'm sorry, I forgot about that. That's what makes it $4,200. Forgot, the jet ski industry contributed heavily to Bush's campaign, so there's also a jet ski in there as well. What is the alert right now? Are we still in apricot, or are we... What are we? Beige. Beige-ish? Seriously, what is it? Orange? Orange? They're saying yellow.
Yellow.
Orange? Yellow. I got orange. I got, yellow. Wow. Yellow. Nobody knows. You know why nobody knows? Because nobody gives a shit. That's why, because it's fucking meaningless. That is why. You know, it's useless information. What are you going to do with that information, you know? Oh, honey, the terrorist alert has been lifted to orange. Oh, what should I do? We'll get the bread out of the oven and let's eat dinner. What? Well, should I get scared? Yes, that's what it's about. It's about getting scared. All right, well, now I'm scared. Now what do I do? Just obey. Obey. That's all you're supposed to do. And look, you know what? I'm really sick of these left-wing kind of conspiracy theory people who are like, hey, isn't it weird how every time there's bad news for the Bush administration, the terror alert goes up, you know? There's over 11 examples of it. And listen, let me tell you something. It's called coincidence, all right? Look it up in the dictionary. It's a coincidence that the terror alert happened to go up after that French report saying that Bush knew about 9/11. And it happened to go up 2 days after they said there was absolutely no link between Osama and Saddam Hussein. And it happened to go up within 36 hours after the mad cow disease and the government might be implicit in it. And it happened to go up literally the day after the report that Halliburton overcharged by $65 million. And it happened to go up when Bush's ratings plummet. It's called coincidence, you fucking hippie freak. Oh, these fucking guys out there on their computers compiling cold, hard, irrefutable facts. Fuck those assholes. Yeah, I'll see you at Burning Man, you hippie. It is. That's great. Every time... In fact, the next time the terror alert goes up and you haven't been reading the papers, go back 2 days and see what's buried on page A24, because that's where the shit is. You know, just bad shit, raise the alert. You know, I'm sure there's a guy in the White House. They've given him his own room. That's all. That's his job. Just hang out, eat sandwiches, play PlayStation 2, and just when some bad news comes down, like, oh, yeah, flip that thing. Derek, flip it to orange. Yeah. Wait, hang on a second. What's that? Oh, shit, really? All right, the president just killed and ate a Jewish baby. Better flip. You know what? Fucking juice that thing to red. This is not going to look good. Democrats are going to have a field day with this one. I don't know how Rove is going to spin his way out of this. Wow. Why did he do it? Well, he just said he wanted to. That is, like, there's not... That's the only evil, crazy thing for Bush, you know, to do that's left. I mean, he must be getting bored. He must be, like, trying to figure out all these ways to get attention. Like, when is anybody gonna notice all the terrible shit I'm doing? What do I have to do? Am I made of fucking Teflon? Jesus. Here, watch this. Hey, Jaime, smile for the cameras.
That's good Jew, baby heart. Yeah.
What are you going to do, Grandma? We're at war. What are you going to do, vote for Kucinich? Ha ha!
Bring me another Jew, baby.
I'm invincible.
The norm is that if you subordinate yourself to the interests of the powerful, whether it's parent or teacher or anybody else, and if you do it politely and willingly, you'll get ahead.
You know, it's common to, you know, to think that, well, the Republicans are the conservatives and the Democrats are the liberals, and to a great extent that's true in domestic policy. In foreign policy, it's not true. In foreign policy, the Democrats have been as aggressive and as warlike and as militaristic as the Republicans, sometimes more so. You take a look at Harry Truman, and Harry Truman has been suddenly everybody loves Harry Truman. Everybody cites Harry Truman as a hero. Republicans, Democrats, I suppose it's, you know, when you've had a run of mediocre presidents, anybody looks good. You know, and people look back and they romanticize these, you know, old presidents, and suddenly, you know, and a new biography of Truman has appeared with 1,000 pages, you know. But in foreign policy, he was really an initiator of Cold War and of the idea of giving arms to dictatorships, and in his case, Greece and Turkey, and you must give arms to them, even though they're dictatorships, because of the Soviet threat, you know, communism, we must stop communism, and so on. I've always been suspicious of the argument that our foreign policy was based on stopping communism, even though it's been used again and again. I mean, everybody knows this. It's been the centerpiece of our foreign... I mean, this is... We're going into Vietnam to stop communism. We're going into, you know, invading Cuba to stop communism. We're overthrowing a government in Chile to stop communism. Overthrowing a government in Guatemala to stop communism. You know, everything... That's a very nice way to present something, because everybody wants to stop communism. And so it's a good way to get support for whatever you do in the world. But as a historian, I start my sentence off as a historian to give tremendous weight to the words that will follow. Historians like to do this. The truth is, you know, historians differ on so many issues, but we like to throw our weight around. It always puzzled me that people should think that our aggressive foreign policy began with 1917. If our foreign policy is really based on anti-communism, then it must mean that, well, 1917 was the year of the Bolshevik Revolution, the year of the establishment of the Soviet Union. It must mean that before 1917, there's no problem. Before 1917, there's no need to throw our weight around in the world, no need to intervene, no need to send Marines anywhere in the world. Before 1917, there's no communist threat. You know, even just a little bit of American history, you know that before 1917, the United States was an aggressive and expansionist power. First on our continent, on this continent. And we didn't get all this territory peaceably. We didn't get California and New Mexico and Colorado by persuading Mexico to give that territory to us. We fought a war against Mexico, a war which we instigated. I know we don't like to think that we instigated wars, but we have instigated a number of wars, and that was one of them. And how did we get from the Atlantic to the Pacific? How did we move from a thin band of colonies along the Atlantic Ocean to a great continental power? We did it by conquest. We did it by Andrew Jackson going into Florida, although, you know, on those schoolroom maps it says Florida Purchase. You mean it was just a commercial transaction? No, Andrew Jackson went into Florida and killed a number of people, and then Spain decided to sell Florida to us. Except that no money passed hands, actually. Florida Purchase. Mexican Cession. That's how it reads on the map. I remember. Mexican Cession. I mean, they just ceded it to us. Why? Just friendliness? No. No, no, we went to war against Mexico and then took 40% of Mexican territory. We were an expansionist power. We expanded into the depths of this country, into this into the Louisiana Purchase, which I remember when I saw it on the map in the schoolroom, it looked like empty territory. Right? There are no people there on the map. It's just empty territory, and it's ours, and we bought it for a bargain, $3 million. And it was only later that I realized there were people living in that territory, lots of people, Indians, Native Americans. They thought it was their country. They thought it was their land. No, we bought it right from under them, right? And then we annihilated them, either killed them or drove them out to make sure that it would be ours. We were an expansionist power, continentally, long before 1917. And then, of course, at the turn of the century, we went into Cuba. Sure, we liberated Cuba from Spain, but not from ourselves. We drove Spain out and then put ourselves in, and put United Fruit in, and put our railroaders in, and put our corporations in, and wrote the provisions in the Cuban Constitution, which allowed the United States to intervene in Cuba anytime we felt like. And then we took Puerto Rico, a few bursts of cannon fire, and Puerto Rico is ours. We go to Hawaii, take over Hawaii, over to the Philippines, just a short, right? Where McKinley didn't know where the Philippines were. Thought they were off the coast of San Francisco. No, they're way out there in the Pacific, near China. And we go over and to take the Philippines, fight a bloody war against the Filipinos, a war that you might say was a kind of a forerunner of the Vietnam War, a bloody war in which atrocities were committed. Filipinos did not want to be ruled by us, and they fought against us, but we defeated them after years of fighting. We became a world power, an expansionist, aggressive world power. Before 1917, we were sending Marines into every country in Central America. We were sending Marines into Haiti and the Dominican Republic for long occupations. We were bombarding the coast of Mexico because Mexico insulted us. Really, they arrested a couple of American sailors, claimed they were drunk, which is hard to believe. So we bombarded the Mexican coast to teach them a lesson. This is under Woodrow Wilson, our great liberal president. Now, I know some of you may think, hey, this man is down on the United States. You know, some people say, oh, wow, you know, this is anti-American. No, it's not anti-American. It's not anti-United States. It's anti-specific governments of the United States that have followed these policies. The government is not the country. The government is not the United States. The government is not American. Well, sometimes it is, maybe. But there are lots of times when it isn't, you know. That's the job of the citizenry, to decide whether the government is behaving in accord with American ideals and to criticize the government when it isn't behaving in a decent way. So all this is happening before there's a Soviet Union. It suggests that our foreign policy, whatever the claim, oh yeah, we're doing this to stop communism, that foreign policy has been motivated like the foreign policy of other nations, other great powers in the world. Motivated by, yes, well, same motivations that moved the British Empire and the Dutch Empire and Spain and Portugal and France and all of them. The accumulation of power, the spread of influence, and also economic gain, corporate power, IT&T in Chile, United Fruit in Central America. So it's not that I'm singling out the United States. It's just that the United States, and this is a very hard thing for Americans, you know, born, growing up, saying a Pledge of Allegiance, you know, patriotism, and well, very hard for Americans to except the fact that the United States is like other nations in the world. We're not the Boy Scouts of the world. We don't just go and help old people across the street. No, we don't. No, we behave like other imperial powers. That has been our foreign policy. And Democrats and Republicans have colluded in this.
A Spaniard who hailed from Alcala, when angered would shout Mucho Mala. He tossed a grenade at a Moorish brigade and blew all those fascists to Allah.
Yippee-i-yay-yay-yay.
Oh, the Lincoln Battalion by cracky, a bunch of brave bozos, the wacky. They held down the line for months at a time against Franco, he'll do cheese lackey.
Yippee-i-yay-yay-yay. Yippee-i-yay-yay-yay.
Was there on the plains of Brunetti, Mr. Hell of Steel confetti. With our planes and air bombs, we would smash Franco's ranks, got sick on Italian spaghetti.
Yippee-i-yay-yay-yay.
Yippee-i-yay-yay-yay. Oh, the Lincoln boys fought at Harama. They made the fascisti cry mama. They were holding the line for months at a time, and for sport they would play with Obama.
Yippee-i-yay-yay-yay.
Yippee-i-yay-yay-yay. A codger from old Albacete took on the 16 goats on a betta. When asked how he felt, he just hitched up his belt and said, I can't tell just as yet.
For years, economists have defined the economic health of a country by its gross domestic product. Trouble is, every time a forest falls, the GDP goes up. With every oil spill, the GDP goes up. Every time a cancer patient is diagnosed, the GDP goes up. Is this how we measure economic progress? Economists must learn to subtract.
Human beings want to be happy. We have a need not just to live, but to thrive. At the most basic level, we need food and water for sustenance and shelter from the elements. And even though it may not seem like it when you watch television, we all really do want peace in our lives. We want a sense of purpose and belonging. To put it simply, we each want to feel satisfied with who we are and what we have. We all want good lives.
Thank you for listening to A Fragment of Time.
I did a 26-city tour of the United States last year, and it was a very interesting time to be in the USA. I was in Louisiana, in the deep south, and the guy who lived next door to where I was staying was reading the papers in the backyard, and it was the day that news first broke from Iraq of this joint Sunni and Shia united uprising against the US-led occupation. Same day, there was news of an Africa Union joint declaration condemning US foreign policy. And the guy next door in Louisiana said to me, I'll tell you this much about the United States, we are sure bringing about world unity. The one thing unites the entire planet, hatred of us. It's like you all became one big nation called the rest of the world. I said to him, well, actually, we did. In fact, we've even got our own flag. He went, oh, yeah, what is it? I said, same as yours, but on fire.
Everybody's gonna get a check for $300. $100. Oh, boy. Wait a second. Hang on a second, Governor Bush. Okay. You're saying, man, let me get this shit straight. Because I heard what Gore said. Now I want to listen to what you said. You're saying if I give you my vote, then for 4 years, you can do whatever you want, roll back any fucking law you want, appoint any judicial, federal judge, Supreme Court judge, anybody you want, fucking change all laws in the land. You can do whatever you want for 4 years. But I'm going to get a check for $300 once. Wait a second, Slick. Hang on. I ain't done with you. Come here. Turn it back. Come here. Okay, that's fine, man. I could use that $300. I surely could. I could use it. My family could use it. My neighbors could use it. Our whole town could use it. But what about your rich friends? What about all them millionaire, billionaire friends of yours? They're not going to get any of our money, right? They don't get any money back, do they? Well, no. They actually get millions and millions of dollars back. But I still get my $300. All right, you got my vote, man. Okay. I'm going to buy me a hammock. But I will give Bush credit for one thing, and it's something he deserves credit for. Because, look, I've been slagging him, but let's be fair. I will give him credit for having the courage and the balls to, in the face of dissent and in the face of logic, to still be able to find it within himself to execute retarded people. I think that's, and it's something his dad did, and he's doing it too, and I think it's awesome. I mean, he's obviously got to reconcile with the fact that he's a born-again Christian, which must be very difficult, but he's able to do it, to find the strength within himself to do it. And I couldn't do it, simply because they're fucking retarded. They don't know what's happening to them as they're being led to the execution chair, the electric chair. They think they're going on a ride. That's all they know. They're being led out of the cell, people taking pictures of them. Ha ha, hello. Strapped in the electric chair. Ha ha, seatbelt for my arm. Seatbelt for my leg. Seatbelt for my head. Wait a second, this isn't a ride. And, that's their last thought. This isn't a ride. And then.
So I like to start the show with a little song I wrote. Ding dong, Bush is dead, Bush is dead, Bush is dead. Ding dong, Bush is dead, Bush is dead. Da-da, ding dong, Bush is dead, Bush is dead, Bush is ding dong. But yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, I haven't worked out the other, but ding dong, Bush is dead is how I'm going to close it, though. People often ask me where I stand politically. It's not that I disagree with Bush's economic policy or his foreign policy. It's that I believed he was a child of Satan here to destroy the planet Earth.